Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme.
These towns were intended to improve people's quality of life, to address the problems with unplanned city life, pollution, congestion, overcrowded housing conditions, and also to help bombed out Londoners, so to address the housing crisis.
Purpose planned and purpose built. The New Towns movement sought to let some air out of the congested industrial centres after the Second World War. But how do these towns fare? And could a new wave of new towns be the cure to some of the 21st century's urban ailments? We'll look at examples from Britain and abroad, and even take a glance through some archive footage too, all coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. The house is finished. Semi-detached, it's 1971. Like the rest of the newly erected cul-de-sac, it sits on what, just a couple of years before, would have been a field. Indeed, the gardens are still nothing more than mud and a tangle of weeds that now stand in the way of my parents' aspirations of creating a pleasant space with shrubs, a rockery, and a greenhouse full of sweet-smelling tomatoes. Oh, and a flowering cherry tree. The house looks rather good, modest but modern, with its timber-clad upper half and large windows. And at the end of the garden, there's a garage and a gravel patch to also park the car. No family has more than one. This is Newtown, Britain, a moment when the nation invested big in creating a series of places that could absorb people keen to leave the big cities for a fresh start. It's many years after the Second World War, but London is not fully rebuilt, and people still want out. And beyond the city limits looks like a place for fresh starts, new businesses, and these freshly minted towns offer a safe in-between world. It's not the countryside, and it's not the city. You don't need to know demanding rural ways or face up to urban grit. It's onto that gravel patch that a car now pulls up for the first time. In the back, my sister, Billy the Budgie in his cage. Up front, my mother and father. Life living in London is over. This scene gets repeated at every house on the road in the space of a few months. Families arriving with kids in tow, wanting change. The promise will get dented. Building a culture, a sense of place, is a challenge. That pedestrian precinct will never really be a place of joy. But as a child, it's kind of wonderful. You certainly feel protected. On a summer's evening, you can be out playing late without parents having to keep watch. There are friends, even if conformity matters a bit too much here. There's a snobbery today about new towns, suburbs. People are seen as overspill, too weak for the city or even the rural slog. But across Europe, there's a clamour for housing and some renewed championing of the new town movement. NIMBYism stops many of these projects in their tracks. So does some bloody common sense. Developers and planners concoct schemes for towns without train stations or schools or hospitals or any decent infrastructure. But the new town model can work. It's not an instant fix. You need some patina of use and of age to add character. You need the shrubs to poke above the newly creosoted fences, flowering cherry trees to grow heavy with spring blossom. But we shouldn't dismiss these places as sleepwalking and culture-free. It's hard work keeping a new town on track, keeping it changing and diverging into more varied versions of itself. But as someone who benefited from a planner's dream, I know that it can work. And every few years, I find myself taking a diversion to drive past the old house, sometimes stopping just for a minute. Dreams and lives outgrow and leave behind childhood homes. But when I think of my parents in that garden, I know that from a blank canvas, you can make a home that can sustain you. But hold on, it's 1971. My dad turns off the ignition My mum is all smiles. We clamber out the car. We push open the gate and a new life can start.
Well, that's my experience of new towns. But the history of the new town movement goes back long before I arrived in my very own purpose-built paradise. Here's Georgia Wrighton, course leader of the MSc Town Planning Programme at the University of Brighton, with some history of the movement.
The New Towns movement itself probably started in the 1920s and 30s after the Garden City movement, and the New Towns Act was in 1946, so it was inspired by the Garden Cities movement in the way that town and country were combined, and there was a belief that bringing the countryside into the town was good for people's health and well-being, quality of life. And the new towns came in after the war. So the radical new Labour government under Attlee decided after the war in the 1945 era that it would be a great idea to build out 10 new satellite towns around London. And these towns were intended to improve people's quality of life. They were intended to address the problems with unplanned city life, pollution, congestion, overcrowded housing conditions, and also to help bombed out Londoners, so to address the housing crisis. Initially, I mean, it seems very positive, because key aspect of it was that mostly the housing was rented. It was mostly rented out by the development corporations that built the new towns, and they were intended to be for a mix of social classes, so more wealthy and poorer people would live side by side. But really, I think as time went on, subsequent administrations really, I think, undermined that spirit of community, and I think undermined the kind of ethos of the new towns in a sense. So it felt as if there was this socialist utopia that was being built, you know, in the brave new world of the 1945 era. And that didn't really fit with the sense that, you know, needing the private market to be entered into everything. And that sense, since the 1950s, really late 1950s, that this was not really the model that fitted anymore with society, and that the invisible hand of the market was kind of creeping into everything more and more. A really important point to note, actually, is that under the original model, the idea was that as the new towns were built out, the uplift in the value of the land as a result of developments would go back into the towns for their maintenance and their renewal and refurbishment. But what happened was, because the land and assets were sold off from the late 50s, that didn't happen anymore, and the councils were left with just the council housing. So I think for me, it seems that is mainly why now a lot of new towns are looking as if they do need refurbishment and renewal and maintenance, because they didn't have that investment that they were intended to have.
So that's where we are now, a paradise lost of sorts. But perhaps there are lessons to be learned further abroad. The New Town movement is by no means only linked to the British Isles, and all throughout the 1950s, these developments were popping up across the continent, with the new town of Tapiola on Finland's southern coast being one of the first new towns in continental Europe. And I'm joined now from Helsinki by Monocle's Petri Burtsov to tell us about this early Finnish example.
Tapiola was one of the first post-war new town projects in continental Europe. Finland at the time was still relatively unbuilt and rural, so we're talking 1950s and 60s, and it thus provided a perfect place to test these new ideologies and new building methods. Finland at that time was living in its heyday of Finnish modernism, and architects such as Alvar Aalto were known the world over, and they were also involved in designing Tapiola, the garden city, about a 10-minute drive outside of the center of Helsinki, in an area that at the time was just forest and uninhabited fields. Tapiola was built in a way that conforms to the surrounding nature very strongly. Private residential gardens of the terraced housing blend seamlessly into the surrounding forest and meadows, and houses also imitate and follow the natural undulation of the landscape. And it's also important to note that Tapiola was planned in a way that several professional groups worked together, because it was believed that no one group alone could solve the problems of modern community planning. So that's why architects and civil engineers and landscape gardeners and so on worked together to create Tapiola.
Now, many cities built at that time, following kind of similar principles, then began to look rather shabby in the following years. Tapiola has always been regarded as a success story, you know, that there was something about it that was unique. But did it suffer some of the same problems in subsequent years? Did people wonder whether it was all aging at the same time, that perhaps some of those modernist Corbusier edges weren't so pretty after all?
I do have to say that Tapiola did start to decay in the 80s and the 90s, but the positive thing is that it's now kind of regained its popularity, and it remains actually to this day one of the most attractive areas to live in the Helsinki metropolitan area. Now, there are those critics who say that very little of the Garden City ideology remains because you now have large shopping centers and high-rise buildings. And while that is true, the town planners in Tapiola have maintained the original town plan with the green belts and the low-rise, low-density houses.
Tell me, in many countries, we're now seeing a demand for new cities to be built, and new homes and new towns to emerge from greenfield sites. Is that happening in Finland? Is there still a new towns movement, as it were, or is there more a debate now about infilling within, for example, metropolitan Helsinki, not expanding any further into the countryside?
Now, that's a very timely question. The ideology up until a few years ago was that Helsinki would always expand. Helsinki annexed lands from its surrounding municipalities, and the plan was always to build new high-rises there where people would move. But that was never realized, because people actually now, they either want to live very far from the city center in kind of more rural settings, or then they want to live in the very center of the city. So what Helsinki, for example, is doing now, it's building new houses as close to the city center as possible, and also tearing down houses in the city center and replacing them with new ones.
Thanks, Petri. That was Monocle's Petri Burtsov there, joining us from Helsinki. Milton Keynes is considered by many to be Britain's most successful new town. Born from an Act of Parliament, construction began in 1967. Since then, this conurbation of 250,000 people has become famous for its abundant greenery, its mall in place of a high street, and a gridded road system punctuated by roundabouts, lots of roundabouts. It's a model that is both loved and loathed by residents, planners, and the general public alike. Andrew Arms is an architect and designer. From 1997 to 2008, he was the chief city architect in Milton Keynes, and he has this confession to make.
For the first 8 years of my time here, I wasn't living in Milton Keynes, and that was all to do with my wife. She had a good job in Oxford and didn't want to be disrupted. She didn't want to disrupt the kids after we'd not long before moved out of London. And also that she said, anyway, I hate fucking Milton Keynes. So there we go. I commuted for 8 years.
So even when the man tasked with designing and improving the city couldn't convince his family to live there, well, that's not a good start, is it? But after Andrew's daughter moved to Milton Keynes, he and his wife Jo soon followed. Now Jo says she loves it. Monocle's Nick Manise sat down with Andrew in his home in Milton Keynes to find out, among other things, what changed.
By actually living here, after all the years of kind of passing through, and like most people, not being able to really identify with the city, she quickly, after a couple of weekends, actually understood that the city was really connected in different ways to other cities, primarily with the landscaping.
Could you maybe touch on that and like elaborate about the legibility of the landscape in the town?
You know, you can go to most places in the world, particularly ones which have had some kind of European influence, whether it's Europe or somewhere where Europe has been a colonial power. You can get out of the railway station, you can kind of look at where you are, and quite often you can assess where things are going to be in that city, just because cities conform to certain centuries-old norms, in a way. with Milton Keynes, that doesn't happen. And you get out of the railway station and you haven't got a clue where you are. And while that sounds desperately unappealing, it's just the way that the kind of city is. And it's not until you actually begin to understand how it connects in different ways that you really begin to understand the city. It doesn't conform to the norms of a city. It's a different kind of urbanism, a different kind of community, if you like. And of course, it was originally set up to be a community of propinquity rather than location. And that's the way it's developed.
Milton Keynes obviously is perhaps the most famous of the new towns. We're 52 years into its life. What lessons from it can we start to apply to architecture and the design of other new towns and new developments?
I mean, one of its great successes is it's mixed. You know, you have businesses, you have residential in kind of basic zones, if you like, but quite close by. And so too many new towns are kind of based on housing only, and then other things apply. Where Milton Keynes fails in terms of how the residential areas are laid out still is that there's no kind of thinking about what might happen in the future as things change. You know, how do you actually adapt a house into another kind of a use? Whereas in a kind of an older town, look at Manchester and all of the conversions of warehouses and things into residential. You know, it's very easy to do. Future-proofing is no big deal, really, if you actually think about it at the time that you're actually designing a city. And that's one thing that I would do if I was in any new town. They should be future-proof, and change of use should be encouraged in the relationship of a building to the street, of its width, floor plate size and so on, ceiling heights, so you could actually change to a number of uses over time and you get a much more diverse and rich mix. And particularly since, as we've learned, that even something which seems as robust as a high street, clearly with changes of technology, is not robust at all.
Robustness aside, Milton Keynes was intended to be a kind of urban utopia, providing a green and lush antidote to overcrowded urban London 40 miles to its south. Residents have always embraced this vision, and the city continues to invest in itself in infrastructure, cultural events, and more. The Festival of Creative Urban Living is one such example and is currently underway right now, a biennial event bringing architecture, design, and high-tech together, all under the urban context of Milton Keynes. Benjamin Forster Baldinius is an architect based in Berlin, and he's part of Raum Labor, the experimental architectural practice that's helping organise the festival. He joined me in the studio earlier to discuss the festival and all things Milton Keynes, especially with the eyes of an outsider.
I've never been to a place where traffic's been separated so radically, so that you can really drive around with your bicycle with never seeing a car. And most of the new towns are higher, right? They're high-rise. So the idea was that you can stack the apartments higher and then you have more space around. And Milton Keynes is obviously built in a different kind of mindset with, you know, this rule that no house should be higher than the highest tree. And normally these new towns in France or in Germany or in Poland or wherever, they have at least up to 10, 11, 15 stories. I think as an urbanist, I was missing the density, or that at least some moments where you get a feeling you are actually in a place where a lot of other people from different classes, from different nations, different generations, kids and elderly and so on are living. And if the only place where you can encounter these people is the shopping mall, that's a bit pathetic, I think. So yes, I was critical, even though I love the radicalism of the city and that it has a great potential. In Utrecht, they just built the largest bicycle parking lot of the world. This could really be a Milton Keynes, because Milton Keynes has the potential that you can go everywhere with a bicycle. It's just maybe after 50 years, it's gotten a little bit too big. So there's lots of things that we'll have to question in the further development of the city. How large can it become, and should we get people closer together so it's more convenient to go by bicycle?
Then you come up with a plan to bring back to the people of Milton Keynes. So what's your ambition for the project that you're going to do in Milton Keynes?
We knew that we have to find a way to communicate certain clearly definable ideas. So we proposed to put together a kind of a festival campus that is situated in the center on this strange street called Midsummer Boulevard that is orientated towards Midsummer Night Sun Down. I don't know. And we will make four interventions that also get a kind of a spatial representation. One of them is we think Milton Keynes needs a bicycle school. We have to re-educate Milton Keynes people to use the bicycle, because the only reason that we heard why people in Milton Keynes are not using the bicycle is they are afraid. So we thought we have to find a way to take that fear away from the people in Milton Keynes, that actually riding the bicycle is something cool and nice. People in London know that already. Why not in Milton Keynes? The second is that we've thought that if they are still feeding their own vision of their own city with images from the 60s, it maybe needs an update. We like the idea that there's people, they're persuaded they live in a utopian place, but maybe there's certain things that we have to think of now in the age that we're in, under the kind of dark clouds that are gathering, that maybe that it needs more ideas, new ideas. So we will build a tower that is a machine to create new utopian ideas. That is called Utopia Station. It is really a big four-story machine where we invite the people from Milton Keynes to come in and put everything that they've always thought this city needs on the table. And then they will encounter experts that can discuss these ideas with them, and we can compare them with ideas that have been made 50 years ago or 500 years ago, and see if this idea is a step backward or a step forward, and so on. And then we will present these ideas to the public.
So an amazing marriage of humor where it's needed, but answering some really huge questions.
Yeah, but this is what we thought was our task. If the task was make a festival of creative urban living in Milton Keynes, this is what it's about. You have to look at the city, what it might need for the future, and I think it needs a vision.
Okay, you've passed the interview. I'm going to give you my vote. You've passed the committee.
Okay. Look, and then there's two other things. One is very simple. It's a meeting place, a roof where all kinds of things can happen that are already happening in the city. And the last thing is just a small kiosk where you can book a night somewhere in the estates. And we found in almost every estate a family that would host a guest. And you can go to that kiosk and say, I would like to stay a night in Pennyland or in Wolverton. And then you will be made into contact with his family and you can spend a night there.
That was Benjamin Forster Baldinius. And the Festival of Creative Urban Living is on now in Milton Keynes until the 13th of October. Book your flights now. Finally today, we take a trip to the cinema to look at an innovative film project seeking to celebrate the story of the New Town movement in Britain and the unique social history of these pioneering towns. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards was joined by Gemma Buckley, Senior Partnerships Manager at the Independent Cinema Office, and a New Town resident herself. She explained more about the beginnings of the project and what it's hoped it will achieve.
We were tasked with creating a programme of archive film that told a story of significance for the southeast of England. That was our brief on this project. So, of course, there's new towns in other areas of the UK, but the majority of the first wave of these new towns were built to relieve overcrowding in London. So this project in particular focuses on the first four new towns, which are Crawley, Harlow, Hemel Hempstead and Stevenage. So we think it remains one of the southeast's most significant shared stories with a legacy and an impact that are still felt and discussed today as in this podcast. And I live in Harlow, so there's a very personal reason for doing the project. But to address your question about where the footage came from, I mean, at the time of their development, there was considerable interest in and indeed high aspirations for the Newtown movement. So as well as attracting national media attention, the development corporations themselves were keen to document this progress, and they chose to record much of it on what was a new medium of film. So as a consequence, there exists this large collection of archive footage of Newtowns, which is actually unique in capturing the development of the UK's built heritage, you know, tracing it from a settlement, from its origins through to the present day.
And I wonder then, from a sort of historical point of view, do you think that the way people viewed Newtowns, you know, right at the inception of the story, has it changed in terms of how, I don't know, even people talk about the towns, whether it's where they're from or just their knowledge of them? Has it changed a lot in the intervening time?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the key aims of this project was to sort of restore this pride in the Newtowns. You know, it's a very unique story. After we'd shown the archive footage in the smaller community screenings across the four towns, we created this feature-length archive programme, which goes from the 1920s. The first film is of Crawley, but that's of pre-Crawley, if you like. It's in the 1920s and it shows the villages. And then it goes through to films from Stevenage and Hemel about the reaction of the farmers, really, and, you know, these newcomers coming in. And then there was this pride through the 50s of, I'm not sure, some of the films are obviously designed to sell the Newtowns in a certain way. Some of them are government-backed, you know, to try and get people to move there. But then, of course, as you go through the programme and you go into the 70s, and then through to the 80s, where our film ends, and people are being more reflective and more critical.
You talked about that shift in perspective, and I guess the pride people feel and the ambitions of the film, I suppose, were a bit more, they were almost like sort of marketing properties in some ways. Mm. But do you think that there are lessons from, certainly from the films, as you've rediscovered them and are sharing them and putting them out there, are there things we can all learn today about this?
Well, I think all the films can teach us something, you know, from the shared aspirations to the shared experiences, and then now very much a shared legacy. When we toured these films in community venues through the towns, you know, we heard the same feedback. And there was a shade of rose-tinted glasses, perhaps, but also the residents identify some instances where they think the towns went wrong, if you like. So the last film, Changing Places, nearly Newtowns, is from 1982, and you have Harlow residents, and actually the planner of the town, Frederick Gibbard, laments the complication and the barriers that prevented him from fully realising his vision. And one thing that is noted in that particular film, they sold a lot of their assets off, and they were left with assets that don't make money but take a lot of money to keep up to date.
It's absolutely extraordinary, Gemma, and I think the project sounds amazing. I'm sure listeners to this programme will want to see these films for themselves, maybe get involved with the project more broadly. How do they go about doing that?
The film is currently touring the UK, so it is available in cinemas, and play dates are available on our website. But also, we really just want to be the bridge between the archives and the audience, really. So any community groups or special interest groups, they can book the film directly with us for their members. So details are on the website as well.
And what's the website?
It's independentcinemaoffice.org.uk.
That was Gemma Buckley speaking with Monocle's Tom Edwards. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. But what have we learned from the Newtown movement that could help us tackle the urban challenges we face today? Well, it seems that if you get it right, and many of these places did get it right in the 1950s and 60s, then people still want to live in these towns. The proximity of nature and good services just kind of works. But what seems to be essential is you have some quality in the build. The other problem with these new towns, especially the ones which have kind of frozen in time in a little way, is that they're a bit too dependent in places on the car, and even their retail models seem a little bit out of date and need upgrading. That's the trouble when a city all ages at the same pace. Suddenly you get to now and you realise that a bit of intervention is needed. But let's not give up on these places. Let's understand that there is a world of refitting and going back into them to make them better places that is wise and sensible, and that should be kept in mind as we build a new generation of new towns. New towns, they're kind of good, you know. Well, today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello, Nick Manise, and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And make sure you get a copy of the upcoming November issue of Monocle, in which Nick Manise
goes to Milton Keynes again. God, we love that place. But to play you out of this programme, here's the Future Heads with Stranger in a New Town. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.